Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, writers. This is Jenny Nash, and this is the Hashtag AmWriting Podcast, the place where we talk about writing all the things. Short things, long things, fiction, nonfiction, pitches, and proposals. Today, I'm excited to welcome novelist Caroline Levitt to the show. She's a prolific author whose novels have landed on the New York Times bestseller list, the USA Today bestseller list, and have been optioned for films, translated into many languages, and won all kinds of awards. Caroline is also the co-founder of A Mighty Blaze, an organization that began during the pandemic to promote independent bookstores and authors who lost their book tours. A Mighty Blaze has since grown into an organization of 35 professional creative volunteers, connecting writers and readers online in a variety of ways, including a podcast. Today, I'm talking with Caroline about her new novel, Days of Wonder, and specifically about the dual timeline and how she learned to trust her gut to make the story work. So welcome, Caroline. It's so awesome to have you on the podcast. Thanks for coming.
I'm so thrilled to come on. I can't think of anybody I'd rather be talking to today than you, actually.
Amazing. So your relationship to a dual timeline plot is not casual. You have written a lot of books with dual timeline plots. You're a teacher, a beloved teacher and instructor of plot development. There, you have so many reasons in your life to be a person who is like, I got this on the dual timelines. And yet you have shared that this particular dual timeline in this particular novel, you said, nearly killed you.
Dude, I've done dual timelines before, but they weren't so different in time span. And this particular book, Days of Wonder, there's two timelines. There's what happened when these two 15-year-old kids first meet in New York City. And I wanted to intersperse it with their afterlives. When they're 15 years old, they both get involved in this attempted murder that they don't remember committing. And one of them, the girl, is charged. And the boy, because his father is a Superior Court judge, he's let off. So there's this whole early section that sets it up and sets up the question of, well, what really happened? You know, how did it happen and why did it happen? And then I wanted to do a time jump where it's like, 6 years later, and I wanted to follow their afterlives, where the girl is left early, she's early released from prison, the boy is now a man, and he's in a new life, and the girl just can't give up thinking and wondering about what really happened back then, because she doesn't know, the reader doesn't know, and she wants to find out, and she also wants to find the child she gave up when she was in prison. So when I first started writing it, I wrote it chronologically. I said, okay, we'll start with the couple, and then I'll do a break, and then I'll go here. And when I was doing it, it didn't feel right. It seemed like I was losing the question of why we were reading the book. And I remember something really important that a story structure person had told me, which is that the present triggers the past, you know, and they can live side by side. And I thought, well, maybe I'll try to do it a dual timeline. I'll do like a couple of chapters from the beginning, and then I'll intersperse it with like 6 years later, then I'll go back to the beginning. And as soon as I thought that, I thought, what am I doing? How do you even do that? So I got pieces of paper and I wrote out in Post-its, I wrote all the events that are happening and like, when the kids are 15, and then all the events that are happening when they're adults in their 20s. And I had to try to figure out, well, what goes where? And the truth was, I had no idea. So I actually hired a developmental editor to help me, which I know is something we're going to talk about again. And I told her, this is what I want to do. I have no idea how to do it. Can you help me? And she was remarkable. I mean, I never could have done this myself. She told me, like, okay, you start with a situation, you know, write it up to, don't write the whole thing, just write at the beginning where they're falling in love. Okay, so that's in that timeline. Then you take that point of falling in love, move it 6 years later. Here's the boy, he's now a man and he has a wife. Weave that in and do that for a while. Working with her, it took about 3 months to figure it out because we kept going back and forth and she would sort of say, well, why don't you do this? And I would go back and think, I can't do it. It's not seamless. Once I figured out, you know, the two timelines are moving on the same track to the ending where you finally find out what happened that night. Once I figured that out, then I could go back and finesse it and try to connect, because you have, when you do two timelines, you want to connect them either with an emotion, like a love story back then, a love story 6 years later, sometimes with an object. Somebody breaks a teacup when they're 15, then we return to 6 years later and the adult woman is drinking out of a floral teacup again. And it's those little grace notes. And I must have rewritten that about 18 million times. It was really, really hard, really, really satisfying. And I couldn't have done it without help. I just couldn't have done it without help. And not just my busy editor, Algonquin. I needed somebody else who would sit with me and talk to me and really help me figure it out.
So you said that when you wrote the story chronologically, you could feel that it wasn't working. Can you remember that feeling? Like what... Mm-hmm. What was that feeling?
It wasn't pulling me along. It was sort of, you know, there wasn't enough. I like to have tension in a novel where you're always wondering, oh my God, what happened? Or what does this mean? Or where are we going now? And when I was writing it chronologically, it seemed too much like this happened, then that happened, then that happened. And it was sort of, I don't know, it just wasn't exciting to me. And also there was too much time. If I did it chronologically, I knew that I wanted, the mystery was what happened that night of the attempted murder. And I knew I wanted three versions. I wanted the girl's version of what she remembered. Then later on, I wanted the boy's version. And then I wanted a final version from somebody else, which ties everything together. And to do that chronologically would have been, you know, you're going to read one chapter of her version and the next chapter is his. And I thought, that's not, that doesn't feel right. It feels like you need space in between. You need to know, like, well, what's his life like now as an adult? And then when he's an adult, something triggers him where he's forced to remember that night. And then we get to hear his interpretation. So I thought that those three things sort of held the book together in a way that was interesting for me, and I hoped it was interesting for the reader.
So you're obviously a pro. You've written a lot of books. I suspect a lot of writers who are new or not so experienced might have questioned the story. If the story wasn't working chronologically, they might have questioned, is this a good story? Is this the right story? Is this a story I want to pursue? And or they might have questioned their ability to write it, to pull it off. Did you have anything like that? Or was it, no, I love the story. I know I can do it. I just can't figure it out.
Well, I've written enough books now so that I know that I can, that I will eventually figure it out. I've come to love the whole process, and usually it takes me 6 months to figure it out before I even start writing. But for somebody new, I always tell new writers, you know what? You can do it. You have this idea, you just have to shut out the noise, and you have to make friends with the feeling of discomfort, you know, and ask for help. You know, ask for help. They should call up you. They should hire you. Well, you know, really, you need to ask for help, because sometimes you're so frozen, you don't know what to do. And also just trust in yourself. Take a moment and realize why this story is important to you. Why do you want to tell it? What's the question the story is asking? And you're not writing for an audience right away. You're writing for yourself in your first draft. And I would just tell people, you know what, you can do it. And you need somebody, sometimes a developmental editor will just tell you, you can do it, or this part is good. And that's all you need to go ahead.
So this question of asking for help is one that is incredibly near and dear to my heart. I think it's the basis of so much trauma that writers cause in their own writing lives, that they think they have to do it alone. And you have been a very vocal advocate of asking for help. And help doesn't have to necessarily mean paid help, but you, I'll share in the show notes a Writer's Digest piece that you wrote on not only asking for help, but telling people that you ask for help. And among very accomplished writers in your circle, I understand that people are reluctant to say that. Can we talk about that, yes, that piece about, are people afraid they're going to lose the ownership of the story? Is that what it is?
I don't know what it is. I've had writers say, I don't want people to know about my process. Or other people say, I don't want people to know that I had help. Some people said, I don't want my editor's feelings to be hurt. I mean, I just, you know, my first four books I wrote all on my own. I asked nobody for help and it was terrible. It was really, really hard. And the moment I asked somebody for help, I realized, you know, and it was another writer, and we just, you know, traded pages. I realized this is incredibly helpful because, first of all, people see things sometimes that you're just too close to it and you don't see it. And other times there are people will bring things up that you never thought of, and it's exciting. And it has nothing to do with losing your work or not, you know, feeling of, I've never thought that any editor I've ever used, either with Algonquin or a developmental writer or friends, I never thought, oh, they're trying to steal my work, or they're going to steal my ideas, or this makes me less of a writer, because I've seen firsthand that it actually made me more of a writer. Because, look, I could never have done a dual timeline by myself. I never would have known how to do it without help. And now I got the help and I know how to do it, and I can go and I can help other writers. So it's, you know, it's really important to be able to ask for help. And also, when you're published with a publishing company, you think you don't listen to your editor there? Of course you do. I mean, it's a collaborative, writing is really a collaborative thing. Yes, the idea is yours, the passion for it is yours. And yes, you do have the final say for what goes in the book, but it's a gift to be able to do that with other creative people and to get guidance. I mean, I can't understand why somebody would not want that. And I tell people all the time, I mean, I actually hire 3 developmental writers, editors, because each one has, one's really good on, you know, the plot, another one's really good on the psychology, and the other one's just good on pacing. And it's really helpful to have those things so you can pick and choose and figure out what works for you.
And in your own helping of other writers, in your own coaching or developmental editing, how do you approach that in a way that's honoring their story and their decision-making and their work, and then doing the piece you're talking about, the here's what I see, here's the holes, have you thought about that? What's your approach on the other side?
Well, I always tell them that I read their, I like to work with whole novels, and I read their book twice. The first time I read it, just to get a sense of what the shape of the book is, because I like to work with structure. And then I tell them, look, sometimes I miss your intention. So I might say something that's going to sound completely ridiculous to you, but that's sort of a red light for you to think, oh, I didn't get my idea across the right way, so then you can go and fix it. Sometimes also I can be wrong. Any editor can be wrong. I try to make them realize that if they're going deep inside themselves to write this book, that's when it becomes universal. And if they know why they're writing this book and what the question is of the book and what they want to do, I feel that it is my job to help them get there. It's not my job to turn it into a Caroline Levitt book. I never want to do that. It's not my job to tell them, don't write about this. It's my job to figure out, why do you love this book? Why? I always ask them, why is this book important to you? And they always get flustered a lot of the times and say, well, it's not that it's important to me, it's important to other writers. And I say, no, 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 no. it's not that it's important to readers. Make it really important to yourself and then it'll be universal. So first of all, there's that trust. They know I'm not going to screw up their work. They know that I'm open to whatever they say. I tell them that, you know what, if you hate, as soon as I hand them the notes, I say, okay, the first thing I want to know is, what didn't you agree with? And what did you agree with? And they know that I'm not going to jump on them and say, well, excuse me, I've written this many books. And I'm going to say, oh, that's interesting. You know what? I was wrong. Let's figure out how we can get you there. So for me, it's like a puzzle piece. And for them, they're sort of finding their way into the book that they really want to write. And so it's a partnership. It's not like I'm up here and they're down there. It's more like we bounce off against each other. And it's really fun. It's really satisfying, as you know.
That's an amazing description of the work. So your why for this novel, I have read some things that you've written that it was a story that came to you soon after your parents died, and that colored certain things, decisions you made in the book, which we can maybe talk about as well. But the seed of the story and your why for this, can you talk about that and how that propelled you in the work of figuring out the structure, the dual timeline?
It was a story that was told to me by a friend, actually, which was amazing. I was told that when she was 15, you know, and she's like a remarkable, accomplished woman now, and everybody loves her. And she told me when she was 15, she had actually committed a murder. And of course, I was taken aback. And she said, well, you know, I was like a car without brakes. I couldn't figure out what to do or how to do this. And she went to prison. And she was early released. And when she came out, she changed her name. She changed her identity, which always interests me anyway. And she had this life until she was in her 40s when somebody found out and she was outed. And her whole thing was, when do I get to be forgiven? What do I have to do? That resonated with me, not because it was somebody else's story, but because it had something to do deep inside me, which is what I always tell people. I grew up in a family where everything was always my fault. And it was always, how do I get to be forgiven? And I created a whole new identity for myself in college, which was a false identity, but it helped me. And when I was finally able to be myself, it was very satisfying. That was what I wanted to talk about. So I told her that I would never tell anybody who she was. I was going to respect her privacy, and I wanted to change the story totally. The only thing I wanted to keep was what happens when you create a new identity. Does it work? And what happens when people find out? And also, how do you get to be forgiven when you're not sure that you committed a crime? I mean, that's where I put in the where nobody really remembers what happened. And those were the things that kept propelling me. And I always tell writers I work with, take the thing that's haunting you, put it on a piece of paper, stick it up on your computer, because that's the reason why you're writing the book. And that was sort of the question that held me to the page. You know, it held me to the page. So I took that story and I totally transformed it. And I was never quite sure how it was going to end until about 6 months in, when I was doing all my mapping. I thought, well, maybe this will work. And I wasn't sure. I had to write it to figure it out. But that was what interested me.
And the question of taking on a new identity in order to absolve yourself or forgive yourself or
just to be in the world,
be able to live, right?
Just to be able to live in the world. I had a really hard time with that for many, many years. I mean, I had a terrible childhood. I was really, really shy. And when I started writing, I was terrified to talk to people. And the way I did it is I had to buy, and I used to tell this story all the time, I had to buy a talisman for myself to pretend to be somebody else. And I bought a pair of these red cowboy boots because I thought the woman who wore those would be kick-ass. And I put them on and I was able to pretend I was her. And I don't have to do that anymore. But it took me years to get back to who I really was and to do that. So that whole idea of identity was very important to me.
So in this story, certain characters, you're playing with identities based on people that you know in your life and that you love, and in some cases and in others not, but that was very much in your motivation. It sounds like the timing of events that happened in your life and the timing of this story coming to fruition in your brain.
Yeah. I always tell writers, everything is always, the more personal you get, the better. I always feel that we writers are the canaries in the coal mines. We go deep into the mines where everyone wants to go because there's diamonds there, but they're afraid to go there because you can die, you can get hurt. But if you're brave enough to go there, you can give a real gift to people and also to yourself by figuring it out. Like, why do I feel I have to be forgiven? Why do I feel that it's not enough to be me? Why do I always feel guilty? I mean, when you answer these questions, it's just a profound sort of release.
That's so beautiful. So back to the timeline work. So you're taking this chronological draft that you had, and you're working with various people to sort it. And it's my reading of the book, I really felt it wasn't, sometimes there's a kind of mechanical nature to dual timelines where, well, right, now we must go here and now we must go there. And right, it's sort of marching in this, not inorganic way. And your story, really, the connection between the timelines is so masterful. The places where they touch each other. So how did you get to that?
I had a lot of help. I actually I'm friends with the writer Jonathan Evison, who is the most generous writer on the planet. And I had long conversations with him because he always bounces around in time. And I said, how do you do that connective tissue? And he said, well, you can do it by emotion. It doesn't have to be activity. Like if in a previous timeline it ends with somebody sobbing, you can pick it up 20 years later with a new character who's dabbing at her eyes because she's just stopped crying. He said, or you couldn't do it with a color, you know? Maybe the timeline ends where somebody's in a bright yellow suit, and then you go 20 years ahead and there's a child with yellow dandelions. It's kind of like, sometimes it can be really subtle, but the mind will make those connections. So that's connective tissue. And it's much more subtle than having to do the, okay, well, I did this, now I have to go back to this. I mean, the only laws I was told you have to do with the two timelines is within each timeline, you want it to be consecutive. You know, like when they're 15, you don't want to bounce around in time. You want to like keep it consecutive. When they're in their 20s, you want it to be sort of consecutive. And then you're just meshing the two. But he was very helpful with that. So I figured out, okay, I didn't know you could do that. And I learned something new, which is always great.
And was there a process where you were very conscious of that in a draft, or was that something that just flowed?
No, it didn't just flow. It was really hard. I mean, first I wrote it out, and then I would try to figure out what went where and what was the best place for it. And then I would look at the ends of one timeline and the beginnings of another and try to figure out what's the best way to connect them. Like, what was there already to connect them? And sometimes it was as simple as I would end like the past where Ella's giving up her baby in prison. She's 15. And then I would say, okay, well, then let's go to Jude, the boy, when in his 20s, and he just finds out he's going to be a father with his wife. And I thought, oh, yeah, maybe that. Sometimes you get a feeling, you know, like where you think, oh, maybe that'll work. And sometimes it did, and that was really helpful. But it took a lot of work and a lot of tries. And again, you have to embrace the process and know that it's not always easy, and that's fine.
And when you're trying this out, so in that situation you just described where you're going to put these two scenes from these two different times together, do you rewrite, or are you just grabbing this chunk and putting it here to see how it goes? Or is that a draft, a different draft?
It usually I will rewrite the end and then the beginning, you know, to see how it flows. Then I will, a lot of times I'll read it out loud to see how that sounds. Sometimes too, what I've been doing, which is really helpful, is I will print it out in a different color font or just a different font, because then it looks new. And then I can sort of look at it and say, okay, does this read right? Does this sound okay? There's a lot of marinating of, you know, things to see, well, they might look okay today. What about tomorrow? Is this going to still work tomorrow? And sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it doesn't.
And what is the role of the developmental editor in your decision about whether it feels right or is going to stay? Is it where you know and you're checking, or is it where you're sometimes not sure and you're looking for a vote? How does that work?
It's both. It's both. I've worked with these developmental editors for years now, so I know that I can call them up and say, I don't know what to do. Does this sound okay to you? And they will say, well, I know your work and I think you should do this or this. But it's usually both. I mean, I work with the development. My process is I like to have a writer's synopsis before I start. Not that the book is going to follow the synopsis exactly, but I like to feel like, okay, I have a beginning, I have a middle, I sort of have an end. Therefore, I can't give the project up. I will work for like months, 6 months on that synopsis. Then I'll go to a developmental editor and say, what do you think of this? You know, is this good? Is this stupid? I mean, a lot of times I don't know if it's stupid or not.
Right.
And they will come, you know, they will come back with comments saying, I don't get it, or I don't understand like what's going on here. What is it you're trying to say? Then I go back and I rewrite it, and it goes back and forth about four times until I have a working synopsis where I figure, okay, I know what this book is about. I know what the question is. Now I can write. In terms of the dual timeline, I went back and forth with the developmental editors like a million times until I thought it was right. And then it went to my regular editor at Algonquin, and he had things he wanted to change too. So it was always sort of, you know, a lot of times too, it's like tonal. Like there were some things where you said, well, if this chapter is ending on an angry note, I don't think you want to pick it up on another angry note. Why don't you do something that's oppositional? And I would try that. I mean, it's like tinkering on a car to get it to run. And it's hard.
But it also sounds like you enjoy it.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I complain all the time about how hard it is. But I always say it with a smile on my face because I love it. You know, yeah. I love that feeling. I've made friends with it because I know that even when it's the most difficult, and I think, what am I doing? I have to give them the money back. I can't like do this anymore. I know that the next day the subconscious will sort of settle things down and it'll work out. And it'll work out one way or the other.
So we're not going to give away the ending, but I do want to talk about you said that when you wrote the book chronologically, you felt that it was sort of flat and there was nothing pulling the reader through. In the book itself, Days of Wonder, there is an incredible propulsive feeling as the reader moves through these dual timelines about what happened on this,
what really happened
on this night. And like you said, the three versions, and you know, this idea of what even is the truth and who carries it and who knows it. There's a lot of tension and it feels, you know, that page turner, it has that sense of the page turner. You can't not want to know. Did you feel, once you got the timelines right, did you feel that was in there and true? Did you say, okay, I've got that piece? Or did that come over time?
Well, it came out over time, because when I first wrote it, one of my writer friends said, oh, you should write it with like, give the three versions right at the beginning, and then we'll follow it. And when I did that, I thought, that's too much front loading. It just felt sticky. And I wanted to also, like, part of my point was that our memories stay with us, and our past, you know, when our past stay with us, it's like anything dramatic will keep cropping up in your life. And I wanted these people to be haunted by what happened in the past, and that they don't know what exactly it was, and they've chosen to live with it. And the main thing I had trouble with whose version were we going to hear first? Because each version I determined, okay, well, the first version is going to be totally like crazy and you don't really know what's going on at all. Second version, you're going to know a little bit more. And I wanted the reader to think, oh, wait a minute. You know, I thought this, but now in this vision, now I know this. And then I wanted the third version to be the one where everything's upside down and you realize, oh my God, this is what happened. Not only do you know what happened, but you know why it happened. And that's sort of the deeper thing. And to me, those were the linchpins of the novel.
So holding this information in your head, which is what happened, who knows what happened, and when will that be revealed? It's three different layers of the story. Do you sketch that out or pin it to the page in any way, or do you hold those things in your head?
I pin it out. I had different color post-its all over my floor so I could see like what happened when and what was the best place. I made timelines. I had a million timelines. I had calendars where I would put in like this happens, and this happens. It was constant juggling to see, okay, so we've got all this. When is this going to be revealed? Then I had to figure out once it was revealed, then what happens? Because these characters are not, they're together at the beginning and then they're apart and they don't, how are they going to get back together, or are they, or what's their connection? There were a million pieces for me to try to figure out, well, what's the best thing to do. And I tried a million different ways. And it was just when you just get this feeling where you feel, okay, this is the right way. This feels right. And that's how I would do it then.
So can you describe that feeling? You get this feeling that this is right. Is it in your head? Is it intellectual? Is it in your body? You know,
not intellectual. It's not, it's like, well, you know, when you're deep in the work, you go into, I call it the zone. People call it other things. You're so into it. You almost don't know what's real and what isn't. And it's just a kind of feeling, this deep feeling of, oh my God, this is it. And you feel like it's real and you're in there. And it's surprising to me when it got worked out. I just thought, oh my God.
So you're fine.
I like, yeah, it was sort of, you know, I have to show you something if I can do this. Okay, can you see this? This isn't actually for Days of Wonder. This is for another novel after that. But I get photographs. I pin up on here because it's right by my computer, photographs of the people I'm writing about. And they're always like in some kind of a mood, like they're upset or they're crying or whatever, because I feel like they're looking at me saying, you better tell a story and you better do it right. And so when I feel that I do it right, I look at them and I feel like they're saying, okay.
That's so cool. And then when do you take them down?
When I start another novel. Right now I'm working on that novel and I'm almost done with that novel, and I need to get like new photographs, and they can't look like models. I always go to Humans of New York and I try to find somebody that looks, you know, pissed off or upset or crazy or whatever. And they talk to me. And this is actually something my agent told me to do. And I thought, yeah, that's stupid. But I did it. And it was so helpful because, you know, you're living in two realities when you're writing. You really are. If you're lucky, you're living in both worlds. And one world is as real as the other. So that feeling you get when it's right, it's so compelling. It's like what I live for. It's, you know, the reason I write, that I figured it out.
Ah, well, that is a beautiful place to end our conversation. And I would say to the listeners of this podcast, which is hashtag I'm writing, it's about writing. If you want to see how this is done at a master level, this dual timeline, read Days of Wonder by Caroline Leavitt. But I'm going to say that, but also warn you, you're going to lose the ability to follow it because the story is so good. There's so much tension. It's so compelling. You know how sometimes in dual timelines, you get to one timeline, you're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And you kind of
skip,
you want the other one. There's none of that in this. And so you're going to have to read it twice. Once, just read it to enjoy it because the story is so good. And then go back and read it to study what she's done and to learn from how she's done it. It's a gift to readers in two levels. So thank you for writing Days of Wonder. And
thank you, Johnny.
Is there anywhere you want to send people to learn about it or look for it?
Yes. Please, if you go to my website, which is just www.carolinelevitt.com, there's all these essays I wrote to support the book. I mean, I actually wrote about one of the Manson girls, you know, who was just recently released, and there's like tour schedule is there, and you can see all kinds of information. I'm always on social media. I always answer everybody. I'm sort of everywhere at once.
Well, that is a great invitation. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Jenny, thank you so much. This was absolutely wonderful. I'm so appreciative.
And thanks to everyone for listening today. Until next time, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag Am Writing podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause, stop.
Stop.
Thank you.